So today there are two lectures. The first lecture I want to focus on this, which is the strong CP problem, which I'll come to in a second. And the second lecture I want to discuss another non-textbook approach to the hierarchy problem that uses the physics we will learn from the strong CP problem. The second lecture I will cover the relaxion, and then I'm envisaging that the last 30 minutes of the second lecture, which is the last 30 minutes of the course, will sort of be a free-for-all. So we can decide amongst ourselves what you would like to hear about in that part. So the strong CP problem is another sort of naturalness problem. It's not it doesn't have the same nature as the Higgs naturalness problem. And the reason for that is that with the Higgs, as we saw, in many examples, we have no way of controlling quadratic divergences that change the Higgs mass in the quantum field theory unless we have some extra symmetry or something like that, or we pray that the UV physics does some magic for us that we don't yet know about. With the strong CP problem, it's a different sort of naturalness problem, which is that, as I will discuss, this is a problem where quantum corrections aren't a problem. If you start off with the parameter that I will discuss, which is the strong CP angle, if you start off with it vanishing, then quantum corrections don't make it any bigger, so that's fine. But we've measured it, or we've tried to measure it experimentally, and it turns out this parameter is extremely small, unreasonably small, and we don't know why it is, why that would be, because other parameters of a similar ilk in the standard model have been measured and they're nowhere near as small. So this has led to a lot of head scratching on the part of theorists for a very long time, many decades. And I'll discuss a few solutions, but the dominant solution, the prevailing solution, which is the axion, which invokes a new particle to solve this problem, is probably one of the hottest topics in BSM right now. So it's been around for a long time, but people are coming up with ever more ingenious ways of looking for its existence. It's also a very good dark matter candidate, which means that it's very well motivated. You can, with one little particle, you can solve two big problems at one time. So this has made it very popular. And I think because now we're even more confused about the electroweak hierarchy problem, a lot of people are turning to this problem to see if we can make any progress on that front. So it's a very hot topic at the minute, even though some of the physics is very, very old. And the other reason why I wanted to discuss it is there's a lot of really cool quantum field theory. We won't, of course, be able to do it in a huge amount of detail, but nonetheless, I will sketch over many of the interesting points, which sort of beautiful quantum field theory that lies behind the strong CP problem. Okay. So as I said before, if we treat the standard model as an effective field theory, we should write down all of the terms that are allowed by gauge invariants. And if we want to focus on the terms that are most relevant at low energies, remember, as I explained, the terms that are irrelevant, the higher dimension operators become less and less relevant at low energies because the corrections they predict for things like scattering amplitudes become small. So we're free, if we wish, to focus on the renormalizable part of the action. And when we do that, there's a term that we don't usually write down, but it should be there, which is the following. I'm going to choose a particular convention for the way I write it, but you don't have to choose this convention. So here, this is just the QCD gauge coupling. There's some pi's. The convention, you'll see why the convention, this convention is chosen. This is just a constant parameter. So we call it the theta angle or theta CP, theta strong. Has lots of names, but it's just a number. This is the antisymmetric tensor. So it gives you an antisymmetric contraction over these guys. And it turns out that this whole guy here is CP odd. So we normally, I'm not sure if you saw this in Veronica's lectures, we normally write this as this guy here as GG joule. So when we contract the antisymmetric tensor over one of these guys, we call it G joule. There are many reasons for doing that, but for now we'll just state that we call it like that. And we usually drop the gauge indices, but they're implicit in the way I'm writing it here. Okay, so why don't we usually write this down? And it turns out that the reason we don't usually write this down, or the reason you might ignore it is quite obvious, but the reason you shouldn't is quite subtle. But it goes really to the heart of two very important things that can occur in quantum field theory. The first is that classical symmetry, a theory that has a classical symmetry, may not, in some cases, so this isn't always true, but there are theories where you have a classical symmetry that is not a symmetry of the quantum theory. Those of you familiar with this normally comes under the banner of anomalies. But there's some really, really amazing physics in there. And the second thing that we will learn about is that in a quantum theory, total derivatives can matter. They don't always, but they can in some situations. So for those of you who are used to working with effective field theories and doing perturbation theory, normally when we have a term in the action that's a total derivative, we bin it. We ignore it, and I will explain why that is later. But it turns out that in certain cases, like this case, it would be foolish to do so. Okay, so first I want to talk about this point A. Classical symmetries are not always quantum symmetries, for those who aren't familiar with this. So to do this, we will think about the standard model and think about the standard model quarks. So imagine we take an action just that has the gauge fields plus some fermions. I'm now going into Dirac spinner notation, so I've been moving around between Dirac and Weyl, but hopefully you can follow. And we just have the kinetic term for these fermions, and it looks like this. So this theory, I have not written down a mass term, so for now, I'm switching this guy off. So I just have this term. And if you stare at this action, you'll see that, you will find that there's a symmetry that leaves the action unchanged, which is that psi goes to e to the I alpha. Alpha is just some constant, some phase. Gamma 5, psi. So gamma 5 is the fifth Dirac matrix. It turns out that this theory has this symmetry. It also has a symmetry where there's no gamma 5. But this one here, we normally call it something like U1 axial symmetry.
Where is the point of the matrix
in exponent? So you can have both. So you can have just the identity matrix, or you can have the gamma 5. It's actually much easier to see this, to see what's going on if you break up your Dirac spinner into two Weyl spinners. And then what you have is you have something like chi bar d slash chi plus phi dagger d slash phi, where these are two Weyl spinners now. And you can see here, because I have the Hermitian conjugate, I can multiply this by a phase, and the kinetic term remains unchanged. And I can multiply this by a phase, and these phases don't have to care about each other, so there are two U1 symmetries. But for Dirac spinners, we usually break them up and call one of them U1 axial, which is this guy, where they both are rotated with opposite phases, and U1 vector, where there's just the identity matrix, and we rotate them both with the same phase. Okay, so this is a classical symmetry of the theory. However, when we're doing quantum physics, we don't just deal with the Lagrangian, and we don't just deal with the equations of motion. We deal with the path integral. So the path integral is usually written, but I'm not putting any sources in, and this gives me a chance to practice my curly D's. Uh, So in quantum field theory, we're dealing with the path integral, which looks like this. And now we have a theory where or a symmetry where we know that this guy is unchanged under the when we perform this phase rotation, this axial phase rotation. But in a quantum theory, that's not enough. In a classical theory, that's enough. If this guy is unchanged, or if he only changes up to total derivative, then that's a symmetry of the classical physics. But in a quantum theory, we have to worry about this guy here. So how many of you are familiar with sort of path integrals and the path integral measure? Ah, more than half. Excellent. Okay. So for symmetry to be a symmetry of the full quantum theory, this guy also has to not change under that symmetry. And you can see that this is a change of variables. You know, if I'm doing a multiple integral over x and y, and I decide to do that multiple integral over x prime and y prime, where x prime and y prime are, say, you know, I've multiplied them by a constant, or I've maybe rotated between x and y, something like this. You'll be familiar with all the different things that you do. Then we know that when we're doing a multiple integral, that we have to take care, you know, if we're going to get the same answer, whatever choice of variables we make, to include the Jacobian of the transformation. If we include the Jacobian in the transformation, we will always get the same answer for our multiple integral, however we've parameterized the variables. So we have to do exactly the same thing here. So our path integral measure now has to be rescaled with the Jacobian. In this way, so this is the Jacobian for this transformation here. And you see that here because, you know, when you derive the path integral in the first place, you see that it's really just an infinite set of multiple integrals. It's an infinite multiple integral. So what happens with the Jacobian? So it turns out that when this is the identity matrix, which is the vector transformation, this Jacobian is trivial. It's just one, and you can see that because for every little slice of psi, I go e to the I theta, and every little slice of psi bar, I go to e to the minus I theta, and they cancel. So it's trivial to see what happens. But for this guy, they're rotating in the same way. So it turns out that this Jacobian is actually not one, and in fact, if you're not careful about it, it's actually infinite. So this was a big puzzle, and I'm explaining this from one perspective, which is known as sort of the Fujikawa approach. There are many ways of seeing this physics, but I find this to be the most physically intuitive. So this Jacobian is divergent. It's not one.
Sorry, remind me. Gamma 5 is the Murphy conjugate. Gamma 5 is its negation, or
Gamma 5 squared is 1. Okay, so I don't, there really isn't time to go through calculating this Jacobian. It's a very interesting, it's in every single quantum field theory textbook there is. It basically involves integrating over all of the fermion field configurations. And when you do that, you can calculate the Jacobian, and it turns out to be that this guy here, what I'm calling j to the minus 2, is e to the I integral of d4x g squared alpha over 32 pi squared gg joule. Okay, so how can you see where that comes from? In here, we had a p mu and an I g, let's call it a mu. It's the gluon field, so I want to use a little g, but let's call it a mu of a. So when I integrate over all of the field configurations of the fermions, those fermions are coupled to the gauge fields, and that will essentially lead to an effective Lagrangian at the quantum level, in this case, it's really at one loop for the A fields. If I were being super duper sloppy, but don't even write this down because it is super duper sloppy. The way you could see this is that if you have interactions between fermions and you integrate the fermions out, you generate interactions for interactions between gauge fields and fermions. You integrate the fermions out, you generate interactions for gauge fields. And that's sort of what's happening here. As I said, you should really consult Peskin and Schroeder or Schwartz or Weinberg or Zrednicki, any of these textbooks, and they cover it. So this Jacobian is not one. It actually involves the gauge fields, and it's this guy here. So then this means that our new path integral after I've done this field transformation is this guy here. So just to recap, when we do this field transformation, when we do this phase rotation, essentially, this guy has remained unchanged, but this guy has changed. But we can capture the effects of the change in this guy through this term here in the Lagrangian. So it shifts an effective term in the Lagrangian. So the theory is not invariant. We perform the symmetry transformation, and the new path integral is not the same as the old path integral because the Jacobian wasn't the same. So this tells you then that U1 axial is not a symmetry of the quantum theory. So this is pretty remarkable. I think of all, as I said, I haven't done it in detail here, but of all the things I learned in QFT that really slapped me in the face as being extraordinary, when I first was learning QFT, was definitely this. You can have a theory. This is a purely quantum effect. This is something you would never, ever, ever see in a classical theory. And it has remarkable consequences. Here we will talk about the strong CP problem, but this actually comes up in many, many places. You can have a theory that looks like it has the scale symmetry that I spoke about before, but quantum mechanically does not. And quite often when we come across some sort of, we call this an anomaly, when we come across anomalies, they are telling us something really deep about the structure of the theory. If you don't like this approach, there are other ways of doing it. In fact, the first way it was really sort of observed in one sense is by considering things like triangle diagrams of fermions. So you can derive exactly the same effective action using these triangle diagrams where you have gluon, 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 and the current insertion here. This would be like a U1 axial current insertion and two gluons. So you get exactly the same if you're careful about how you regulate this. This is naively has problems with UV divergences and gauge symmetry, and you have to be careful. But when you do the calculation, you get exactly the same effective interaction generated. So that's what I was alluding to up there. What's nice about the Fujikawa method is that you see that this answer, you immediately see that this answer you get is exact at all orders. So if you do this, you might think, well, this is the answer at one loop, and then I can do some more work. I can find out what it is at two loops and so on. But with Fujikawa, you see very directly that this is it's not just a one-loop effect. This is the full answer. There are also other nice things you can learn, that this thing is not actually renormalized, which is why there are never any big quantum corrections to it, unlike the Higgs potential. So once you have a term like theta in here, this guy will not get renormalized.
Sorry. Yep. What is so special about the triangle diagram, like intuitively speaking? I didn't compute these kind of diagrams.
Pardon?
What is so special about the triangle diagram that makes it important for the...
So you get different triangle diagrams in different situations. If you were calculating Higgs decay to gluons, it looks like this, but you don't have an axial insertion. So you can use it not for this sort of topological... I will come to this, but we call this sort of topological term. You can use triangle diagrams all the time for things like particle decays, pion decays, things like this. But quite often they can, these particular ones can give you a hint as to whether or not there's an anomaly. And it's a very quick way of seeing if there's an anomaly. So you can take any global symmetry in your theory and play this trick and count. So for example, there are no anomalies in the U1 B minus L in the standard model. If you wanted to derive that using path integrals method, you could do that. It would probably take you a long time. But a quick way to do it is to look at all of the you know, sum over B minus L charges in here. So put every fermion and put its B minus L charge here. Let's call it Q B minus L. And then, you know, electroweak gauge bosons or hypercharge or gluons, and you'll see that there's no anomalies. They all sum up to zero. So it's a quick, sometimes the triangle diagram's a quick way of seeing if there's an anomaly or not. Yep.
Is it possible to have like the opposite of an anomaly in the sense that neither your action nor your path integral measure are invariant, but the combination is? So in this example, so the measure shifts by that GG dual term. Would it be possible to add a term to the Lagrangian such that the Lagrangian shifts by its negative and that the combination is invariant?
You'd argue that anomaly cancellation and string theory is a little bit like that, right? Because there's a form field that's not invariant, and then the measure is
right
anomaly and they're canceling out.
Yeah, what do we normally call that? Not Green-Schwarz, but is it Green-Schwarz? When they did that, I mean, that is, yeah. Good questions, yep.
So I've been staring at this gamified, because normally that's used when you've got, like, when you're separating the left and right-handed components.
Right.
And in the past, when I've seen people doing this rotation, is just a phase shift, not a change from left to right-handed chirality.
Yep.
Shift. And I'm really baffled what that gamified version is. Honestly, I'm sorry. I normally...
So this guy here, if you act on this, the two component spinner.
I mean, like, it's because I feel like it means you're only doing the phase shift on the component that you shift from between vertical.
No. So a Dirac spinner is just two vial spinners. Let me call it chi, and I should call it psi or something. So when I do this thing here, I go e to the, in the top, I go e to the alpha I alpha, this guy. And in the bottom, I go e to the minus I alpha. This is all it does.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. I was doing the wrong expansion.
Yeah, sometimes vial spinners are easier to, I always find them easier to work with. Okay. Another neat thing about this is that now if we have a symmetry that's classical and we spontaneously break it, we would normally expect to have a Goldstone boson. But if it's anomalous like this, there's no guarantee that you will get a Goldstone boson. And in fact, that this is essentially what's behind the resolution of the puzzle. You know, when I was talking about the pions yesterday, I said there was an SU2 left cross SU2 right symmetry that was spontaneously broken to SU2 vector. So we get three Goldstone bosons, the pi 0, pi plus, and the pi minus. But I was actually lying to you a little bit, because it's really that there's U1 left cross U1 right cross SU2 left cross SU2 right broken to U1 vector cross SU2 vector. So there should be another Goldstone boson corresponding to the U1, that extra U1, which is U1 axial, which is actually this symmetry. And there's no such Goldstone boson in QCD. And the resolution of this puzzle is that U1 axial is now actually a symmetry of the quantum theory. So QCD, although we like to do classical calculations a lot of the time to make our lives easier, QCD doesn't care about that. QCD doesn't care about this symmetry. So it doesn't provide you with a Goldstone boson. OK, so now let's add a mass to this story. So we now have our action looks like this. And if we allow for a phase in the Dirac mass term, I can write that as a complex mass psi bar psi plus Hermitian conjugate, or I can write it as the real part, multiplying psi bar, and I'm going to write it as e to the minus 2i, I call it theta q, gamma 5, psi. So this is just what you get. I'm not going to go through the algebra because it's trivial, but this is what you get if you have a complex Dirac mass and you add the Hermitian conjugate of the action. You can write it in this way. So now we can perform, we might want to go to a canonical basis where we have a basis where we have no phases in the mass terms. That would make our life easier. So we would say, okay, well, easy. Just do psi goes to e to the I theta q, where theta q means the phase that was in the quark mass, gamma 5 phi. However, now this isn't a symmetry. I can't use that. You know, this won't change. This would be just enough to kill off this guy, and we would have a nice, neat action. Sorry, L gauge. But now what we get is because of the anomaly, we get this guy here. So you see that we actually can't get rid of this guy in this theory. We do a symmetry, you know, transformation to try and cancel it off, but it's not actually a symmetry of the theory, so it's a physical parameter. We try to push it out of here, we can push it out of here, and it just gets pushed into here.
Is the that phase theta q, is that spatially or temporally varying? Is that
no, it's just a phase in the mass parameter.
So if it starts out that the quarks have real mass, they'll always have real mass, and this never is a thing?
If you could find a theory where the quark masses have no phases, then exactly that wouldn't be there.
Okay.
That's difficult because we know that the quark, the CKM matrix has a phase. So we know that the quark mass matrix has phases in it mm-hmm. because there's CP violation in the Kaon system and others.
Okay.
But yes, absolutely. If you could find a theory, and I'll discuss that, where that never shows up, then it will never show up again. Super. Okay. Similarly, there, as I said before, there was nothing to forbid us having this term in the first place. So we could have also started with let's call it just theta g squared over 32 pi squared gg joule. And now my new action would have been theta plus theta q, g squared over 32 pi squared. If you don't like this term in here, you could entirely get rid of this term by doing another quark transformation and pull all theta and theta q into the quark mass terms if you wanted. This is a handy thing to do for some calculations. But whatever we do, we can't get rid of this linear combination. We are stuck with it. However, there's reason for hope because this term here, this term here is actually a total derivative. This term here, you can actually write it as theta plus theta q gg joule. You can actually write that as theta plus theta q with a total derivative acting on a current. We normally call this current people use the term Chern-Simons current, because when dealing with anomalies show up in many places in theoretical physics, and there are a lot of sort of interesting mathematical connections to some sort of more formal mathematics that people have done involving differential geometry and so on. But for our purposes, it just looks like this. I'm writing it just to convince you that you can write it this way. So this term is actually a total derivative. So why would we care about it? Normally, and this isn't even quantum physics, this is now just classical physics, normally if we have a term in the action that is a total derivative, we don't care about it. The reason we don't care about it is that it doesn't contribute to the equations of motion. So if it's a total derivative, I can use, you know, Stokes' theorem or whatever to write this as the an integral in one less dimension because it's a boundary term, which in our case would be the boundary of space-time. And when we not only does it not contribute to the equations of motion, which are a bulk thing, that's why you can see it doesn't, because it's living on the boundary, but when we do perturbation theory, we are already implicitly assuming that fields vanish at infinity. So it doesn't show up classically, it doesn't do anything in perturbation theory, so why would we care about it?
Excuse me.
Yep.
Is there any special reason for the two-thirds here? Or?
I could redefine my A to have a different... it's just in this choice of convention that you get a two-thirds. And that may actually depend on... I'm not sure if that depends... No, it doesn't depend on the group. So that's the structure. You can also... Yeah, it's totally convention dependent because the structure constants are convention dependent as well, the overall normalization. So if you wanted a one, I can find a way for you to write it with a one.
We have a repeated upstairs like color index. Are you using the Einstein summation convention on that?
Yes, always.
Okay.
Always. Okay, so why should we care about total derivatives? It turns out that when we're doing perturbation theory, we're essentially assuming the fields are vanishing at infinity, so we don't ever care about boundary terms. But there can be non-trivial physics that cares a lot about boundary terms, which is a good example for thinking about this is the Aharonov-Bohm effect. So as we learn as undergrads about the Aharonov-Bohm effect, you can have an electron a long, long way from a region where there's a magnetic field. You can even shield that magnetic field from the electron so that the electron doesn't experience any force, you know, if you move it, associated to that magnetic field. And as far as it's concerned, the magnetic field is zero. Yet, if you move this electron around this particular magnetic field configuration, even though it feels no magnetic field, it picks up a phase shift. And that phase shift is physical. You can measure it in scattering experiments. In QCD, so that was just QED, and it's not totally analogous. But in QCD, there's analogous effects that can arise because of field configurations. Field configurations known as instantons. So you can have field configurations that do vanish at infinity. So the gauge fields, as we for an instanton, if we go right out to the boundaries of space-time and measure the value of the gauge field, it will be zero. And that's very important because if you want to have any sort of finite energy field configuration, it has to vanish at infinity because the integral over all of d of space-time times whatever the Lagrangian is with evaluated on the instanton, which is the field configuration. If this is going to be finite, this had better be zero when these guys go to infinity. But analogously to the Aharonov-Bohm effect, these field configurations can actually be very non-trivial. The way to think of them, so there are, and you can actually find very simple analytic, well not very simple, simple analytic expressions for what the field configurations are in terms of these gauge fields. But what they essentially do is that you will have in the center of your space-time, you'll have some non-trivial field configuration. It has an action that's finite, so it has finite energy, but not necessarily always zero energy. You know, there's some energy because there's some non-zero fields with some non-zero gradients, so the derivatives acting on the fields pick up non-zero things. But nonetheless, as you go out to infinity, the fields are vanishing. But they wrap around the space-time in a particular way. So for example, and this is like sort of like if you were to think about monopoles or something like that, or if you had something like an Aharonov boom where in some instance you pick up a phase of pi, but in the next instance you might pick up 2 pi and then 3 pi or something like that. There are field configurations like this that wrap non-trivially around the space-time and have finite action. You can plug these guys into the action, and you can actually, you know, do semi-classical physics. You can plug them not just into the action, but into the path integral itself and see what their effects are. And it turns out that the effects tend to scale like 1 over e to the minus 8 pi squared alpha over mu. When you plug these field configurations into L and perform the usual instanton calculations, this is what you get out. But I don't have a slick argument for why it's scaling like 1 over alpha like this. You know, if you go to sort of a normalization of the Gauss field kinetic terms where you have 1 over alpha in front of the kinetic terms.
Isn't that because the alpha is like your expansion thing? So because it's capturing the non-productive effect, so it's 1 over alpha really.
I know it's it's not a perturbative series, but I don't know why it's always e to the 1 over alpha. I don't I can plug it in. I can plug in the instanton.
Yeah, I think if you keep track of your h, and then you find out that the h is associating with that, so it has to be below that.
Yeah.
And that h actually captures your perturbative.
But why not some other function? You know, this is a dimensionless quantity, I agree. Right, yeah. So it's obviously not a perturbative expansion, but there are many functions I could write down that are not a... I don't have a slick argument for it. So alpha is the gauge coupling. Good question. So an alpha is the gauge coupling, and it's a running gauge coupling, which tells you some important things. So the first is that... Pardon? The gauge bosons to anything charged under QCD, the gauge coupling.
Okay.
So alpha is a running coupling, and it runs logarithmically. So when you plug that log in here, you see you actually get a power law sort of behavior. It also tells you that the effects of these instantons are going to be absolutely non-trivial or absolutely trivial when alpha is much, much less than 1. So if you're in the perturbative regime, it's absolutely fine to ignore these instantons. But if you're in the non-perturbative regime where alpha of mu is of order 1, so at energies around the QCD scale, this can be an order 1 quantity, so these effects, which would normally be very, very suppressed when you're in a perturbative regime, are actually unsuppressed.
So I have a possibility argument. So this is from your Euclidean Lagrangian, right? So exponential I something. So this is actually the leading order non-perturbative effect.
Sure.
Exponential minus this L thing, and L thing have this 1 over alpha. But I can't remember. I learned about this at some point.
Right, sure. So as I said, if you plug the field configuration to the path integral, this is what you get for instantons.
Right.
But I don't know a general argument that non-perturbative effects should go like that.
Right.
For instantons, yep. But for general non-perturbative effects, they always seem to come in like this. And I don't know a general... I totally agree that it has to be dimensionless and I'm not a perturbative series.
Right.
But if I wanted, I could write down other things that might show up, but I totally agree. For instantons, that's why you get this. Yep.
How do you find these field configurations?
You do a lot of work. So a lot of super smart people, who were sort of, I guess you would call them mathematical physicists, discovered these field configurations. So right from the start, you can look for all of these sort of topological things. You know, if you even start with a scalar field theory, you can look and see if there are finite energy field configurations. And then you can expand about that background and do quantum mechanics about that background. The guys who found these did it for gauge fields. So Tuft, Polyakov, people like Witten, Coleman. So a good place to look for a lot of this physics is Coleman's book, Aspects of Symmetry. It's really superb. But yeah, people worked hard. And there's an enormous amount of really incredible physics here. So when you put these field configurations into here, not this, sorry, this is the current, but the configurations of the gauge fields into here, for these instantons and integrate over them, you get an integer. And that integer counts essentially the number of times the field has wrapped around the sphere at infinity. And not every groups that have an SU2 subgroup will do that for you for if you're doing this in 4D. But there's an entire field, an incredibly rich field of sort of topological effects where people study these sorts of things. But yeah, so people did some work and found these field configurations. Okay, so there's reason to believe that actually this term will have physical effects, because although it's a total derivative, whenever the QCD gauge coupling is of order one, the total derivatives may give you, if they're non-trivial topological effects, I say topological because it's sort of, you can think of it as living on the boundary. If they're non-trivial topological effects, then there could be physical effects. So we would like to calculate what the physical effect of such a term like this is. And it would sound like that's going to be an enormously painful thing to do because, it is a little bit painful, but it's not as painful as you might imagine, because you could put in, choose whatever your field configuration is for the gluons, put it in, and try and calculate things. But it turns out that that nature is a little bit kind, and we can just use the chiral Lagrangian for pions, which I keep coming back to estimate what these effects are. So when we do that, we can rotate. The way to do that is you can rotate, and we will do this in more detail in a few minutes, but you can rotate these terms back into here. So take completely eliminate this term, if you want. And now you've got quarks with a phase in their mass. Then when these quarks condense and you essentially get the pion condensate and the pion field, and we can plug in what we've done in the last two talks, which was plug in the nonlinear realization with this phase in here. It's now theta q plus theta. So you get an effective action. We will do this for the axion in a second, so I'll just say it in words. You get an effective action for the pions that involves this phase that was in the mass matrix. And when you include this phase in scattering diagrams, so you can try and redefine the pions to move this phase away, but you'll always shuffle it somewhere else, just like in the UV theory, which is QCD. You can move it around as much as you want. You can place it wherever you like it, but you can never get rid of it. And that is also true in the chiral Lagrangian, when you work with the pions and protons and neutrons and so on. And some of those same very smart people in the 70s actually calculated the effects of these phases. And they come in through diagrams like this. So now we're in the chiral Lagrangian, so this would be a neutron, a proton, and a neutron. This would be a pi minus, for instance. And there are diagrams that also, other diagrams that involve the neutral pions, other diagrams that involve the eta mesons and other bits of junk. But it turns out that this guy here generates a neutron electric dipole moment. So you can see that it generates a coupling between the photon and the neutron. The neutron is neutral, but there is a higher dimension operator, which is a dipole moment operator, that is generated. It's suppressed by, you know, 1 over m proton and things like this. But it's non-zero. And then the neutron electric dipole moment in units of E turns out to be proportional to precisely this combination that we know we can't get rid of, multiplied by this function of the masses. Okay, so this is a very, very old calculation. This is a calculation from, I think, the mid-70s or something like this, but it has stood the test of time.
Is there something special about the bottom vertex?
This one? Sorry, yes, good point. So in some convention, as I said, you can move this phase around. I put this like this because that's where the phase shows up in this diagram. But that's basis dependent, so I shouldn't have really done that. You can choose any basis and calculate the neutron EDM and you get the same answer. yep.
This is maybe a dumb question, but I feel like there's other, that the neutron interacts with photons, even though it's not charged, like they bounce off of it, it can remster along if it gets really hot.
Right.
What is special about this coupling that it creates a dipole moment and none of the other neutron-photon couplings do?
Ah, very good. So this is a CP, right? So this is a CP odd interaction.
Okay.
So that's sort of what singles it out. Yep.
In this calculation, your neutrons and proton, do they appear as skirmions in the pylon Lagrangian?
Ah, I don't know. Good question. I didn't dig that much into that into the papers, but. I think in the one of them that I've seen, they're really just treated as fields in the effective field theory. But I don't know if there's more advanced.
I mean, the pylon Lagrangian just has the gold stones, right? The pylons.
Right, but this is the QCD effective Lagrangian that has the neutron and proton and the pions and the etas and things like this.
Okay.
But I don't know. I mean, I'm sure this has been revisited many times, so I'm sure there may be other effective descriptions that have been used to check it. Okay, so the puzzle now is that this thing is something that we can just go ahead and measure in a lab, and all you need is neutrons and things like magnetic fields. So magnetic and electric fields. So you do that and you measure it, and it turns out that this has been measured, and it's less than you measure it and you find that theta plus theta q has to be less than or equal to 10 to the minus 11. So this is a dimensionless number. those are where the current limits are. They've been sort of creeping down over time. So we know that this phase in this total, this sum of phases is extremely small. Now, as I said, this is not, you know, this is, we say it's radiatively stable. Quantum corrections aren't going to make it bigger. But there's also an enormous puzzle because there was nothing in the first place that said that this theory, that this parameter shouldn't be written down. You could try and invoke this parameter violates CP, as I said before. So you could try and invoke CP as a symmetry of nature, but CP is not a symmetry of nature because we've measured in CP violation in the kaon sector for a long time. So we know that CP isn't conserved, and indeed we know that the full quark mass matrix, even if we just consider three flavors, has a phase in it. So why isn't this phase, this overall phase, there? Maybe they're both there, but they're just fine-tuned so that they cancel each other down to this level. It's a possibility, but it's a big puzzle. So this is what's known as the strong CP problem. Why, when we have CP-violating terms, or a CP-violating term in the standard model, in the quark mass matrix, why does this CP-violating term not show up either here or there?
Are there lots of negative phases?
Pardon?
Can you have a negative phase?
Right, or you could, because these are angular variables, you can define it between 0 and 2 pi, or minus pi and pi.
So since you're saying that the sum of them could, so normally one treats this as additive, and so like, presumably it's more problematic with two of them, but the obvious way is if there's two of them, what you're actually saying is if one of them can be negative, you could have a combination of this small with two larger angles.
Right, so yeah, so they can cancel each other up mod 2 pi,
yeah,
because it's an angular variable.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But yeah, so this
more fine-tuning than just saying they're both very small?
No, it's just fine-tuning the sum. So there's no constraint on any independent one of these guys.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot measure them separately. The physical combination is this. The constraint is on the sum. So you can pick these two whatever way you want to get down to 10 to the minus 11. But that's that's the problem. We don't know any. We don't have any information about them individually. Okay, so there are some solutions to this problem. And I will come to the axion in a second, but I just want to mention some. So the first is the massless quark solution. So if one of the quarks were massless in the fundamental QCD action, then you can see here, if I choose mu to be 0 or md to be 0, or actually both of them to be 0, if I would like to do that, then the neutron electric dipole moment goes away. So we have no puzzle. So that's a very quick way of seeing that you can do that. The other way of seeing it is that imagine M were zero here, and I have this term here. I could perform the field redefinition, the symmetry transformation, to pull this phase into the quark mass term here, but M was zero, so it has no effect. So that's known as the massless up quark solution or the massless quark solution. The problem there is that if you set one of the quarks to be massless, you can then go ahead and calculate things like the spectrum of pion mass, the pion masses. You can calculate other properties of low energy QCD. You can do this on the lattice, for example, where you take the path integral for QCD and put it on a computer. And you don't get the right physical spectrum. So this, I wouldn't go as far as to say that this is definitely ruled out, because maybe there's some subtle effect that's been missed somehow. But it certainly appears that if you try and take one of the quarks massless to get rid of this problem, you get much bigger problems in when you're confronted with other sets of data, like the meson masses and things like this. Another possibility is known as spontaneous CP violation. So the idea here is that you would want to have a UV theory, say up at very high energies, that's the true fundamental theory. And you want that theory to completely respect CP. So CP to be a symmetry of nature at high energies. And then when you go to low energies, you want the phase in the CKM matrix that I think Veronica will have discussed. You want that phase in the CKM matrix to come about spontaneously. So the high energy theory respects CP, but at low energies, you spontaneously break CP and generate that phase in the CKM matrix. Now, there are ways, and the best known way is known as the Nelson-Barr mechanism. There are ways of trying to arrange your UV theory such that when you spontaneously break CP, it doesn't feed into this, so it will give you the CKM angle, but not this angle. So that's a possibility. Although those theories are, they're sort of a proof of concept, but they're very, very complex. So they're very, very complex, and sometimes you might need some miracles to happen. Although I don't know them well enough to give a fair assessment. But then possibly the simplest and certainly the most popular class of solutions is known as the axion. So what's the axion? I'm going to put this up. So it's maybe still useful. No. So the axion was sort of, the symmetry story behind the axion was noticed by Roberto Peccei and Helen Quinn in the 70s. And then it was Weinberg and Wilczek who wrote down the sort of the story involving this light scalar that I will come to. And it was Wilczek who gave it the name. So the axion, and I'm sure you've heard of this, the axion was a type of detergent. And he thought this particle was so neat that it solved all these problems so quickly and effortlessly that he named it after a brand of detergent.
I thought that was apocryphal, and it was named after the axial symmetry of the U1A.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's obviously
multiple reasons.
Yeah.
Oh, you say that because that's because of its detergent, right?
Yeah. No, yeah, obviously, yes, it's related to the axial symmetry, but I think, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Okay, so what's the deal with the axion? So as we've learned many times, when we spontaneously break a continuous global symmetry, we get a massless Goldstone boson. So the recipe here is to have a U1 symmetry, call it U1 Peccei-Quinn, which is spontaneously broken at some high energy. It doesn't matter what it is. Well, we'll come to that in a bit. The complex scalar field that spontaneously breaks that symmetry, we can parameterize in the usual way, in the nonlinear realization. So it gets a vacuum expectation value that's f over root 2. We'll call rho the radial mode. So we've done this many times now. And we'll call a the angular mode. So as I said, this is just one clever way of parameterizing the 2 degrees of freedom in this complex field. Rho is the radial mode, so he's sort of like the Higgs boson. He's heavy. And we can essentially forget about him and from now on just work with this guy here, who is the Goldstone boson. who is massless. So then you will choose, so there are many, many ways of doing this, but you will choose a setup in which your quarks essentially have, up to these anomaly effects, have Petchiquin charges. So one way you could couple this guy to standard model particles would be just via the sort of standard Yukawa interactions. So we could have this guy, some higher dimension operator. There are many ways to do this, so I'm just gonna write one of them. So this is assuming here that essentially the quarks are carrying a charge. Say this guy carries charge plus one under U1 Petchiquin. Then one of these guys, say the right-handed or left-handed component, is carrying charge minus one. So then when we expand out in the nonlinear realization, we get an interaction that looks like this. We get lambda F over lambda. So F is a constant, lambda is a constant. So I just reabsorb this into the effective Yukawa coupling. And then the standard model Higgs field, and then something like this. I've written theta q because there's nothing to forbid there being a phase already in this term here. And I'll include the possibility of a phase over here at the same time. It's the same thing.
So lambda tilde is a shower.
Yes. And then, if I want, I can perform the same chiral rotation or axial rotation that I discussed earlier to remove this guy and pull it in here. So I can rewrite this as L prime. It's physically equivalent. Yep.
There's a phi over lambda.
Yep.
Did that turn into the E as well, or where did that go in the?
So yeah, as I said, the F over lambda. So then we have lambda F over big lambda, and I'm just reabsorbing that into what I'm calling lambda tilde. Okay.
Sorry, is there gamma 5 in that?
Yeah, sorry.
No, but in the one above it.
No, because here I've got Hermitian conjugate.
One line up higher.
In here? No. So yeah, so a quick exercise over coffee time or lunch. Put a complex number in front of psi bar psi plus Hermitian conjugate, and you can write it as real psi bar with a psi and the gamma 5 in here. Yep.
Does the Higgs have a U1 charge?
It can in some models. This is always, there are so this is an effective action, and there are a bazillion ways to get at it. Absolutely.
If it has a U1 charge, does that mean that you have to pay him everything else in that, all of the normal things, other things
that
interacts with the U1 charge?
Yeah, exactly. So this is the details of the UV completion, but once you choose your set of U1 charges, you should write down everything that you're allowed, absolutely. This will be one of the terms. Okie doke, so now we can perform a chiral rotation, which moves this guy into here, as we did before. So this now becomes and we don't have this term anymore. Okay, so are there any questions at this point about what we've done? We could have equivalently, not equivalently in terms of the UV physics, but equivalently in terms of the low energy physics, have just put the axion in here from the get-go. There's ways of doing that, which I will discuss. But in the end of the day, because you can always perform these phase, field redefinitions, which rephase the fields. You can always pull what's in here into here and back and forth in whichever way you want. So as long as you can get, the physical thing is always the linear combination. So long as you can get axion over F somewhere in here or in here, you're good to go.
Excuse me.
Yep.
With this construction, the whole thing we've been doing, would it also work with neutrinos?
So neutrinos don't couple to QCD.
Yeah, but if you use an SU2 instead of SU3, would it?
Right, so yeah, so exactly. So if you were doing the electroweak gauge fields, you could get a term like this.
Yeah, yeah.
But that doesn't give you a neutron electric dipole moment.
I mean, is there some other observable effect if you do this?
Good question. So for hypercharge, no.
Yeah.
It's trivial. But because you don't, essentially for hypercharge, you don't get these field configurations.
Yeah.
But for electroweak, for the SU2 sector, you do actually get these instanton field configurations. But this is a very good question. So let's see what happens. So the electroweak gauge group is broken at 100 GeV essentially. So mu in here should be 100 GeV or so. So an alpha weak evaluated at 100 GeV is a pretty small number. So the non-perturbative effects will be very small, but in principle they're physical. I think you could perform measurements that would access them in some way, but they're very small.
Okay.
Yep.
Why is H there?
For gauge invariance. So this is like, Q, U, C. This is the standard model quarks.
Yeah.
Super. Any more questions?
Can you spell out the exponent at basically the last line?
This guy here?
Yeah.
E to the I gamma 5 theta Q plus theta plus A over F.
A over F.
Yeah. So where A is a field.
Yeah.
Okay, so so now let's see what happens to this axion. So once again, we go to the chiral Lagrangian for the pions. You can see why I spent so much time on it at the first lecture. Because the chiral Lagrangian or some analogy of it shows up all the time. Okay, so in QCD, the pions, the quarks condense. And I'm going to be slightly sloppy here, but if I take M quark, let's just call it M psi bar psi, this whole guy, well, these guys condense, and you get a non-trivial vacuum expectation value everywhere. So if you are to ask the question, what is the expectation value of finding psi bar psi field at any given point in space-time, then it is non-zero. And these condense to become some constant, f pi squared m pi squared. So I've included the mass term here. In reality, you also, like we did yesterday, you put in the full nonlinear realization of the pions. So there's the pion fields, Goldstone bosons, in here as well. But for now, we're going to ignore them. They don't really change the story much. To do an honest-to-God calculation, you would include them. But we don't need to. So let's see what happens here when the quarks condense. Sorry, not pions. So this guy here condenses, and what you get is, sorry, I'm going to carry this over here now. What you get is that this term in the action becomes f pi squared m pi squared e to the I theta q plus theta plus a over f plus Hermitian conjugate. So I'm actually going... Sorry, I apologize, but I'm going back to essentially this term here. So the Higgs has got a VEV, so we got a mass term. So M is lambda tilde V. And I've written it as mass psi bar psi plus Hermitian conjugate, which is equivalent to this. Okay, so now we have this complex number plus its Hermitian conjugate. So what you see is that you get F pi squared M pi squared cosine of theta plus A over F. So this is the term in the Lagrangian. The potential, the Lagrangian has the kinetic terms minus the potential. So the potential is for the axion now, is minus F pi squared M pi squared cosine of theta plus A over F. And this field, just like with the Higgs potential, we have a maxima at the origin. So if we want to do quantum field theory about the vacuum of the theory, we go to the vacuum, which is the minimum of the potential. We want to do exactly the same thing here for this field. So we solve the equation, dV by dA. is equal to zero. And where does that lie? That happens when the vacuum expectation value of the axion over F is equal to minus theta Q minus theta. Or let's do minus theta Q plus theta. So now you can see how the axion solves the strong CP problem. Because there was a global continuous symmetry, classical symmetry, that was spontaneously broken, so we get a completely massless Goldstone boson. However, that symmetry is not actually a symmetry of the theory. It was anomalous. So QCD will give it a mass, but it turns out that it gives it a mass and, in fact, a potential, such that at the minimum of the potential, it will automatically exactly cancel the phases, the strong CP phase, in the whichever linear combination it has shown up. So is there anything not clear about that?
I have a question, apparently not, and you might have kind of avoided this by your derivation, but when I was reading about this a while ago, they said there was like the potential, there's an effective potential, which they just stated looked like that, but you had the Lagrangian that, as it was written, still just had the A, as it were, you've got A,
GG
dual. Yeah. And so going, and there was nothing that other else that depended on A and Lagrangian essay at that
right.
point.
Yeah.
And so I still don't really understand how you're supposed to go from there to there, because
I just did it.
No, let me rephrase that statement. How the Lagrangian having, are these terms that you're adding to your Lagrangian?
Nope. No. So I could start without this guy here and write, so this is a good question. Right.
Like GG dual had to have A dependence at some
right, exactly. But I can pull my whatever's in here.
Yeah.
You know, back and forth. I can have it in here. I can have it in here. Doesn't matter.
Okay.
So if you start, so this is a good point. So if I started with just the standard model, just this guy here, and I wrote A over F in here,
mm-hmm.
I do my field redefinition and pull these guys into here.
Okay.
And then keep going from here. So which is why you will always get the same axion mass. However you manage to jam it into the action in the first place, there are many ways of doing that,
okay.
But you will always get the same answer. Okay. And I agree, normally it's just put in here and then the potential is written down. But these steps are so trivial that it's worth
okay. showing. I thought somehow that the GG dual was getting A dependence, and that was very weird.
Right, well it sort of is. I mean, in reality, the physics doesn't care where you put it.
Yeah.
So if you... and yeah, I mean, so there is a way, although I've never really seen it entirely done, there's probably a way of keeping it in here and deriving the same potential, because this turns into what's gives you rise at low energies to what's known as the Tuft determinant interaction, which has four quarks in it, and that has a vacuum expectation value that would then contain this guy. So there's probably a way of doing it from there, but because I'm in love with the Carroll,
yeah.
with the pylon action,
it definitely makes more sense. I can see how that worked.
Yeah.
I just don't, so does this mean that the gluon field strength tensor are actually the definition that we stated use if the axion on the right is incorrect? Because it
no, not at all. No, because the physical question doesn't care where you put it.
Okay.
The physical observables only care about this linear combination, whether it's here, part of it's over there. It's sort of, yeah. Okay, excellent. Yep.
So is this not a problem that you had to have this expectation value for A? So you've introduced this scalar field, and it follows this massless escape Goldstone boson.
Yeah.
And then you're saying that its expectation has to be this very specific value.
It doesn't have to be. It will be. This is the potential you get. Go to the minimum of this potential. It's here. So this is why it's a dynamical solution. So it could have started, and this is part of the great axion story, but it could have started at some other place in the early universe, not at the minimum, and it goes, just like the Higgs. So you know the Higgs scalar potential looks like this. If you did quantum field theory about here, you would get things like causality violation, all sorts of things, because it's tachyonic. This is not the minimum of the potential. So the Higgs, however you start with it, will end up down here, which is the minimum of the potential. Then you expand about there, because the energy, total energy, wants to be minimized. So that's what happens here. Yep.
So I started as a Goldstone for the U1 Pichy-Quinn.
Yep.
So to give it a potential, you've had to explicitly break that somewhere. Is that from the...
No, so this is from QCD. I didn't give it this potential.
Yeah, but as in...
So this is the anomaly.
Yeah. But that has to be explicitly broken, otherwise A would have a flat potential now.
Right, exactly. So the U1 is anomalous. The explicit breaking is the anomaly.
Right.
So the anomaly generates the potential, just like the E to, as I was saying, for the E to prime earlier.
Yeah.
U1 axial is not a symmetry of the theory, so that would have been a Goldstone boson. Okay.
All right.
But QCD, and it does exactly the same thing here. So there's a classical symmetry, which is the U1 Petchy-Quinn.
Yeah.
Spontaneously break. Classically, we get a massless guy. Quantum mechanically, QCD doesn't respect that symmetry. So QCD will generate a potential, and you can, in a couple of lines, derive it. It's this guy here. Okay. Excellent. So we have 15 minutes left. So yeah, if there are any more questions about this, please ask them now, because this is sort of key to this, the axion story.
So what happened to the lambda tilde coupling?
So that's M. Yeah, so it's a good question. So when the Higgs gets a VeV, this is lambda tilde V, which is just the quark mass. In here. Excellent. Okay. So there are many, many neat things about this. The first is that this is a dynamical solution to the strong CP problem. It involves symmetries. The whole structure is based around symmetries. But what it's telling you is that however you start with the universe, if this field, if this axion field is there, then it will automatically, at low temperatures, go to a point that cancels off this guy here. So if you perform any measurement of the neutron electric dipole moment, you'll find that it's zero. Or if the axion, if you manage to displace the axion a little bit, it will be just, you know, non-zero. But in vacuum, it will be zero. So this is really remarkable. Another remarkable thing about it is there, you can see there were not many bells and whistles here. You start with a U1 Petchy-Quinn symmetry, and you spontaneously break it, so you get a Goldstone boson, and then everything follows from there. And the other nice thing is that this is very predictive. So let's expand A around its vacuum expectation value. So let me call A tilde is equal to A minus or plus theta Q plus theta F. So now we want to, so we go just like with the Higgs, we don't expand right here, we go to the true vacuum. And then we expand about there, and we can look at the excitations about there, which is that's the Higgs boson. So we'll do exactly the same thing here. So we'll go to A tilde, which is the excitation around the background value of the axion. And in terms of A tilde, not V is now just minus F pi squared M pi squared cosine of A tilde over F. So we can calculate now, so dV by dA tilde is zero, at A tilde of zero. But we can also calculate the mass of the axion. So d2V by dA tilde squared, evaluated at A tilde equals zero, so this is just the usual definition of the mass. That's MA tilde squared, which is just F pi squared M pi squared over F squared. So that's the mass squared. Can everyone see that? Is it getting too low down? Yeah, okay. So MA tilde squared is F pi squared M pi squared over F squared, but F pi we've measured for a long, long time. M pi we measured for even longer. And so there's only one parameter, which is F, which is the scale at which the U1 Petchy-Quinn symmetry was broken. So this is extremely predictive because it tells you that essentially the most important properties at low energies are determined just by one parameter, which is this guy F. Okay, so what mass can it be? So when you actually calculate this, just plug in the numbers. You can look them up, presumably, in the PDG.
Wait, hold on, before you move on, where is
the cosine? Because e to the I alpha plus e to the minus I alpha is cosine.
Oh, right.
So you can calculate an MA. Is about 5.7 times 10 to the minus 6 electron volts multiplied by 10 to the 12 GeV over F. So if F is 10 to the 12 GeV, then this is its mass. Now, F is essentially a free parameter. So the, in the original model of Weinberg and Wilczek, F was associated, this was sort of essentially a two Higgs doublet model, and F was associated with the electroweak scale. So F would be, you know, 100 GeV or something like this. But it turns out that you can then, you know, because this theory is so predictive, that tells you what the mass is, and you can go and search for it, and it wasn't found. So we know that F is not that low, and I will come in a couple of minutes to what the bounds on F really are. But there are two different ways that you can get F essentially to be whatever you want it to be. One is whether or not, not just two, but the two most popular ways are known as the KSVZ model, which essentially generates those interactions for you, the interactions you need involving GG Joule by including heavy QCD charged quarks in the theory, or the DFSV model, which has heavy scalar fields. At low energies, you essentially get pretty much the same effective action. You might get different Wilson coefficients, but the structure is the same. And F can essentially be a free parameter. So that's the mass. What about the couplings?
So those are just particular UV completions?
Exactly. Absolutely. Okay, so the other couplings, all of the classical couplings, so we know this shift symmetry of the axion, which is the non-linearly realized Petchy-Quinn symmetry. We know that classically in the action that is respected. So that means then, and this we discussed this in the first 10 minutes of the first lecture, that means that whatever the Wilson coefficient is for some interaction, you will be able to write it, the interaction, in this form here. At least this form. You know, where theta is some operator that might involve any sorts of standard model fields. So theta mu could be, for example, some quark bilinear or a lepton bilinear. Could be that Chern-Simons coupling that we discussed earlier. It could be the electromagnetic equivalent of the Chern-Simons current. So then when you integrate by parts, if you put this in here for electromagnetism and integrate by parts, you get a term that is A over F, you know, C, let's call it gamma, gamma, F tilde. So this is now for electromagnetism. So that doesn't look like a total derivative. It doesn't look like it respects the shift symmetry. But you can always write it like d mu j, d mu L A multiplying j electromagnetism, which is the same as what I wrote down before. Okay, so these are all the sorts of interactions it could have and more. And the whatever the coefficient of these guys will be depends on the UV completion. So there'll be different UV completions, will give you different coefficients. but that doesn't matter so much. And we can see that these are also all higher dimension operators. So they have a derivative acting on the axion field. So that will pick up its energy in any scattering amplitude divided by F. So this tells you that the scattering amplitudes will be proportional to E over F to some power N. At lowest order, it will usually be something like N is equal to 2. And going back to just the same statements we made yesterday about effective field theories, then we see that there are two ways to look for the effects of this axion. We could go to very high energies, close to F, then these terms will be of order 1, and you could look for them, for the effects of the axion. Or if you can measure something with very high precision, you can afford to have E over F being very small, if you can measure it. And one of the neatest places that you can do that is with stars. So this will be the last little bit of the lecture. Okay, so we know that there are all of these sorts of interactions that the axion can have. And one of them is that the axion can, a photon can scatter off an atom. So this is the Z electrons in an atom and give you, for example, an axion and the Z electrons. So you can produce, if photons and electrons are in the game, also new protons, they can bounce off each other, in particular in a star, and produce axions. And stars are big. There are many sorts of interactions like this. So even if the interaction is very small, like I said, if E over F is very, very small, you can still get an appreciable production of axions. So you can view this in this way. So you have something like gamma coming in, scattering off an electron. And the terminology we use is that you bremsstrahlung off an axion. And if these interactions are very weak, then the axion can actually get out of the star. Why would you care? This must be, right, a massively subdominant sort of process compared to standard model processes is what you would naively think, because the temperature in the star is something like 10 keV or something like that. F might be 10 to the 10 GeV or something, so we've got an enormous suppression here. But the neat trick is that the other processes involving heat transport in the star are not volume effects like this. So this can happen anywhere in the star, and if the axion is weakly coupled enough, it can get out. But if you think of the other sort of processes that are comparable, in nature at least, not in rate, like just scattering photons off electrons, if you scatter a photon off an electron inside the star, that photon just keeps getting rescattered. There's nothing escaping the star. So the cooling of a star from, you know, processes involving just photons and electrons is purely a surface effect. All the cooling, you know, there's heat transport in the center, the heat is coming out and it gets to the surface and then it can escape. Whereas the cooling from axions is a volume effect. So we can very quickly, I'm going to do a super fast ultra back of the envelope calculation. So this will be wrong probably by a couple of orders of magnitude. But you can see how this works, because we can just take our naive effective field theory, knowing that the amplitudes are going to go something like this. Sorry, the matrix, yeah, so sorry, I said 2. N is 1 for the amplitude, and then in a production mechanism, so you square this diagram, you'll get E over F squared. So we know that the rate of axion production, which will lead to cooling, will go something like EA over F squared times it'll be proportional to the number of particles in the star, number of protons and electrons, things like that. Whereas the cooling for photons should go something like 4 pi alpha, just comparing one for one here, because I've got E squared from this guy. I had E over F in here. I squared E over F here, so I should square my E squareds, something like that, times the surface area, which will scale like n to the 2 over 3. N in a star is something scaling something like 10 to the 57. So you see you've got an enormous number here. So when you have such an enormous number, whether it's the exponent is 1 or 2/3, really makes a difference. You can plug these numbers in and calculate whenever, you know, when will gamma A be sort of comparable to gamma. Because if the cooling starts to become comparable, then this means that you could see observable effects, because we can see the cooling of stars. So if the cooling from axions is comparable to the cooling from just emitting light, then you should be able to tell a difference. You can plug these numbers in, assuming EA is something like 10 keV. You just plug these numbers in, super back of the envelope, and you find that this will occur whenever F axion is something like 10 to the 5 GeV, which is an enormous coupling. This is an energy scale that we don't access with the LHC, for example. So when you do it in detail, this was just a main sequence star, like the Sun. If you do it for a main sequence star in detail, you get something like 10 to the 6 or 10 to the 7, so it wasn't too far off. But I've ignored many factors of pi and all sorts of things like that. You can get similar processes in things like supernovae, white dwarfs and so on, the supernova tend to give the strongest bounds, because essentially what happens is that the axions can allow the supernova to cool more rapidly. And a supernova inside the supernova, it's so dense that not even neutrinos can escape for a little while. There's a few seconds before a neutrino can actually get out and release the heat. And that's how they dominantly are one of the main processes of heat loss in a supernova. So if axions can compete with that, you can affect the rate of heating rate of heat loss of the supernova, and then you can change the time at which the neutrinos manage to escape. And you could measure this, and we measured neutrinos from a supernova in 1987. So you get constraints from that. And the constraints go all the way up to something like 10 to the 10 GeV. Okay, so I think I should leave it there, and we will pick up the story after lunch. But just any questions?
Yeah, maybe you said it and I didn't hear, but are there, apart from experiments and observation, are there any constraint on FA, so the mass of the axions, like from the theory?
Yeah, good question. So on the upper end, it's very hard, although not impossible, to get in a theoretical setup an F which is, where did it go? Which is much larger than the Planck scale or something like that. Although there are now actually models. But that's sort of a theoretical upper bound. As far as a lower bound, not really. There isn't really a theoretical lower bound. So all of the constraints are really experimental. Yep.
Is the neutron dipole moment the only measurement that depends on theta?
And my answer is I don't know if others must, because it's a physical parameter, so you must be able to find some other process that depends on it. But that's definitely the one that we can measure most precisely. So that's the most sensitive measurement. But it's certainly not a theorem that's the only place it shows up, or maybe it is, but I can't imagine it.
It's like your first solution where you said you'd say maybe the upper part of the masterless,
yep.
That would only resolve that measurement, right?
Ah, right, but theta, if the up quark is massless, because you can always rotate away theta then, theta becomes completely unphysical, so no measurement will access it.
How does, neglecting axions, how well is self-cooling understood?
Very well. I mean, so it depends. So you don't, for the supernova, they need to use models, but still, even including systematic uncertainties, you can get a bound. But things like white dwarfs, for example, which is one of the main constraints, white dwarfs just sit there and get cooled. There's no heating process for white dwarf. So once a white dwarf is formed, it's just sitting there getting cooled. And we can look at how cold, even assuming, so we can look at globular clusters, which contain very old white dwarfs. And even if you assume they've been cooling down for 13 billion years, how cold would they be now? You know, and so if they had some extra cooling process like this, they'd be much colder than what we observe. We actually see a lower limit. That's like one of the ways, not the only, but one of the ways of measuring the age of the universe is to take a white dwarf and see what's the coldest white dwarf you can see in the universe. Because they cool at a very predictive rate. It's just essentially, just radiative cooling from the surface.
There's also this energy loss bound, right? So this is cooling, but there's also an energy loss, so it burns much faster. So a lot of solar system would have died out by now. But which one is stronger?
Right, but a white dwarf doesn't burn.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I'm just saying the red giant.
So. Yes, exactly. Absolutely, yes. So red giants, exactly.
But you're saying the cooling is stronger than the...
No, I mean, it depends. I can show you, I was going to show it, but... I'll show at the start of the next plot. I've got all of these bounds put on, on one plot, just taken out of a paper. And yes, exactly. So there are other, red giant cooling as well, horizontal branch star cooling, and supernova. But supernova manages to access the highest FA. But interestingly, in a supernova, if you reduce FA, then it starts to scatter again because it's so dense. So it's actually a window. The bound will always be a window. Any other questions? It's over.